Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the AgThentic Group. I'm Sarah Nollet. At this point, it seems like pretty much every major food company has announced their commitment to making their supply chains more sustainable. It's not quite as common, I think, to hear the flip side of this story, that farms are operating sustainably at scale and are looking to build supply chains up to big brands. Today's guest, though, she's hearing from more and more farms who are doing just that.
And I love that, because once it goes grassroots and it's coming top down and bottom up, the solutions we're going to find in the middle are going to be fair. And I think they have a better chance of long-term success and being able to find that sweet spot of being big enough to get that scale and that efficiency, but still small enough to hold on to your mission.
That's Jesse Delo, an independent sustainability consultant and chief hub officer at Veda, a new venture that's focused on using technology to enable regenerative farming and improve agricultural operations, environmental outcomes, and the quality of food produced. Jesse's work has centered around connecting environmentally conscious food businesses with innovative farmers, and this work has been informed by an incredibly diverse career. Since her start in Chicago, Jesse has been an organic urban farmer in Denver, an extension agent in California, a farm founder and manager near Boston, and today a full-time consultant. Throughout this work, she's cultivated a love for both working on farms and for the excitement and challenge of early stage startups. Since the launch of Delo Consulting in 2016, she's been working with industry and nonprofits to reimagine supply chains, in particular around environmental and sustainability metrics. These two themes have long been the backbone of Jesse's work, and today she's excited about how central they've become within the whole ag sector.
When I entered into agriculture, I was always thinking about how do we do this in a way that is profitable and sustainable? And how do we do it in a way that's good for communities? And whether that's communities of farmers or communities of eaters. And so I also like a challenge. And when I came into this in 96, organic and sustainable was the fringe. And I like the fringe. And I really appreciated the values and the way that people in this space were connecting with each other, sharing stories, working through things from the ground up, because the system didn't exist. We were doing organic before there was a certification. And I love that messy space of seeing this big opportunity, breaking it down into parts and figuring out the space where I can add a lot of value and doing everything I can there. And it's been fascinating to see the conversation shift from at the time sustainable agriculture being really hard and really on the fringe to today, where it's baseline. It is the cost of doing business means you have a sustainability program and you can tell me how it's operating and what are the potential benefits of that.
I wonder, even going back to when you were in the Central Valley talking to these farmers about fertilizer use, like what was the kind of sustainability vibe or conversation then? And I don't know if that contrasts with being in the room with those corporates talking about collective impact. And then now, like in my head, those are three really different rooms to be in.
Yeah, I would say 20 years ago, talking about sustainability was a bit of a dirty word. You didn't just throw that out carefully. It was like, you leave that at the farm gate. Like, you come here and talk about what yield, price, access, risk. But it has evolved dramatically. I would say that when the conversation started with the food companies, it was more of the marketing side. It was the marketing and branding saying, I'm trying to capture the consumer's interest who is telling me they care about the earth or they care about their health. And so that was the free from era. We don't want pesticides in our food. We don't want sugar and preservatives in our foods. And now we're seeing more and more frequently that a sustainability division isn't just kind of an off to the side, but it's either working cross-functionally or even better is when it's connected directly to procurement. And that is the part of that I'm really impressed of, you know, the Unilever model, because they've been doing this for 10 years in a very advanced way, but they have kept sustainability and procurement together. And that relationship is very essential, because we can do a lot of work on the sustainability side, but if the procurement team doesn't understand it, doesn't value it, doesn't know how to source along those principles, we lose our capability to have meaningful impact on the landscape.
And I would even take it a step further. Like, the incentives for the procurement departments are often around cost cutting or cost reduction, not hitting any kind of sustainability metrics, which may in some cases be more expensive. And so you actually have this like counter incentive where they're working against each other, let alone working together.
Absolutely. That's true. I think procurement is driven by productivity and efficiency. You know, that is their motivation. And I would say that our entire agricultural system has been designed around productivity and efficiency. And now we're in this moment that we're saying, okay, at least we have to include sustainability. So we need a three-legged stool. And then the sustainability division can push forward and say, okay, this is regenerative. This is net zero. This is social justice in sourcing. And we have a lot more work, but that change at procurement and helping them see why am I sourcing what from where, you know, is still evolving. There's no sustainability team that I am aware of that is telling procurement where to buy products. And I don't know if we'll ever get to that space, but I do think that the food companies are doing a better job of kind of living up to their public-facing commitments, as well as their internal business functions, because they see it that the sustainable brands grow faster, the brands with purpose grow faster, and consumers stick with it and they resonate it because you've shared with them a story that is very meaningful about that farmer in California and what they're doing and that they're making practice changes every day because they are getting demand signals from the consumer.
When we looked at some of the drivers for the changes in these food companies, we put it in a couple buckets. One would be like profit or consumers in the sense of it's getting pulled through the supply chain, as you were saying, which is definitely true. My sense is it's still in the kind of niche category. Another might be hitting targets, whether it's their CSR targets, or now we've got Task Force for Climate Disclosure and some of these more commercial, almost access to finance, social license kind of targets. And then you might have more like political, whether it's a country's net zero commitment or something like that. What have you seen in terms of the drivers that are pushing change in these organizations? And is that something that's changing?
I think it's often when the leadership starts to care. At that moment at which the CEO or the C-suite says, we really need to do a better job. And part of that is that they're getting messages from procurement and supply chain, like that we're facing a lot more risks. We're having these kind of point of failure moments that are rippling through our system, and sustainability agendas, regenerative and net zero commitments are going to mitigate some of that risk, not right away, but in the long term. I think we are all pivoting and really thinking about, okay, where do we need to be in 2030? Where do we need to be in 2050? And some of that is just driven by just pure supply chain and climate change and all of those challenges we see. But a lot of it is being driven by the investor space. Even your biggest food companies in the world are reliant on investors and the way that they want to partner with you to push your agenda forward. You cannot be successful in food right now without an ESG program. And that is really completely different than it was 5 or 10 years ago. And I think that we were just, for those of us who are so deeply in this, it's shocking to think about it because it is just so mainstream right now.
I was just going to ask what this has been like for you being the, you know, one in the room talking about this stuff that was a bit fringe. And now like you probably everyone knocking down your door to say, we need this expertise. And you're like, where were you 20 years ago?
It does feel like sustainability professionals are having their moment that we've arrived or you've arrived. We've been here the whole time, but we're also learning a lot. The systems are changing. And this is why I think regenerative is just such a different model than what we've ever seen before. Because now we're saying we want data, we want metrics, we want to hold your hand. We're going to audit through this. We're actually applying a whole different process to sustainability than what we developed previously was like, let's create a certification for that. And everything we did in sustainability up until recently was like process-based and certify it. And that shift towards the food company saying, here's my goal, my supply chain has to hit those targets, it changes the onus on the relationship and it changes the way that we actually go and have relationships with our suppliers and our farmers.
It's so interesting to me that you describe it this way because I totally understand the certification model and why that's, I would say, highly disruptible. Like you're sort of based on practices, but not on outcomes. And there's a million different edge cases, et cetera, et cetera. When I think of regen, one of the criticisms has been it's principles based and it doesn't have that kind of underlying data or science element, but that's not at all how you're describing it. So to help me bridge the gap here around why regen is really different and how it's has this kind of data and metrics element.
In my experience in working with, I think, are the leading brands in this space. Yes, it's principles based. That's the outward message. That's the marketing and communication story. When it hits my desk and people say, I want a regenerative dairy supply chain, it is a very rigorous approach, say 4, maybe 5 major categories. If you turn to me and say, Jess, develop a regenerative dairy sourcing solution, I'd say we need KPIs and metrics for carbon, soil, water, biodiversity. And that fifth one could be animal welfare. It could be social justice. It could be a whole bunch of issues. And then from there, we are going through a whole theory of change. Okay, so if you're going to do carbon, how are you going to do it? How are you going to avoid it? How are you going to sequester it? What are the data points that I can gather from my suppliers realistically without being overly burdensome, but having high quality communications and a high quality program that I feel is accountable and verifiable to all the people I'm assuring, consumers and investors alike? You cannot run a regenerative program without working through that entire process of what are my targets for carbon? What am I going to measure? How am I going to monitor it? Who am I reporting it to? And how do I verify this is happening? So there certainly are going to be actors out there that just throw a label on and they go grab some products. But if you're running a global supply chain, these are very rigorous programs reliant on a lot of data and a lot of communication between supplier and buyer.
I think one of the challenges is, like, we've seen brands come out and make this commitment and they're going, wait, where do we get non-GMO grain? Or how do we make regenerative mac and cheese? That's not actually easy to do. We need this whole supply chain to come together to make that possible. Or do you have any stories of bridging the gap between what a corporate might want to put on their marketing and what actually needs to happen, boots on the ground?
I mean, I think my time at Pipeline Foods, which is a supply chain company, I remember being in a conversation with a challenger brand. And they said, we're going to talk about soil health on our box. And I think I laughed out loud. And I was like, how? We have tried this. The biggest companies in the world have tried to get consumers to care about soil health. It's not going to work. And they're like, okay, we'll just put the farmer's face back on the box. And I was like, that's not enough either. And so y'all are the marketing people. You're the experts here. And I feel for them trying to talk about carbon, like an element in our environment, like that you saw on your chemistry periodic table. I just don't want to be the marketer in that office that day. But I think the role of infrastructure is a really interesting one, because there were a lot of assumptions made about the organic space that the way we were doing things was inefficient or ineffective, or it just wasn't allowing for kind of the productivity to take off, and that we had all this pent up demand in the marketplace for organic. And then we created an infrastructure solution, and still we have that pent up demand and that production is elsewhere. And I don't think that is going to change anytime soon, because what organic did when it grew up was created its own system and its own market. But I do think it's been fascinating to see some of those organic companies have to really change the way that they're telling their own story and looking for, well, what is the change that we're making? And they lean in on social justice or farmer livelihood and things like that. But interesting to see the challenge to talk about soil health in some of these systems, because these folks are so science-based. Nobody wants to make a claim that is not legitimate, and they truly care about saying what is actually happening in their supply chain.
A lot of Jesse's recent experience in building supply chains has been in the dairy industry, which she believes will be a, if not the, major driver of regenerative practice adoption. And when it comes to the challenges of building alternative supply chains, often from the ground up, Jesse says dairy is a leader.
I can think about, like, dairy farmers. When I started doing dairy sustainability 5 years ago, I'd go up and talk to some of the cooperatives, and it was arms across the chest, just shaking their head at me. It's, oh, it's you. And they're like, the hippies have come to tell me how to farm. And it takes years of relationship building to really get people to trust you and help them see that I'm on your side. I want you to understand where the market is going, where the consumer is going. We are all responding to somebody else. And now the dairy farmers are coming to me and saying, listen, I'm cover cropping. I got 12 months of soil cover. I've got multi-species cover crops. I've put solar panels on my barn. Can you help me build a dedicated supply up to that niche brand? And I love that, because once it goes grassroots and it's coming top down and bottom up, the solutions we're going to find in the middle are going to be fair. And I think they have a better chance of long-term success. And being able to find that sweet spot of being big enough to get that scale and that efficiency, but still small enough to hold on to your mission. And I think we're going to see more and more farmers start to come together and build up those networks and go to market with like that.
One of the things that strikes me is this kind of jump from, like, sustainability, do less bad stuff and kind of market it better, and then regen, and then moving into net zero, where you actually have this, like, clear metric that you're aiming for that's tied to the kind of global context, global and national targets, et cetera. And it's much more quantitative and focused in some ways. Like, you're not actually talking about a bunch of the other aspects of the system. It's truly focused narrowly around carbon, and that maybe makes it a bit easier in some ways to hit on. What have you seen in terms of the rise of net zero, and then why dairy in particular as well suited to be a leader in the space?
I think for better or worse, carbon is a good common metric. It allows us to understand soil health. It provides us indicators for water quality. It helps us see biodiversity improvements. Is it an ideal, tangible, something I can get my head around? No, but it, as a metric that we can use from farm to buyer, it's working. And as food companies put out their net zero commitments, it really truly holds our feet to the fire. Like, we have a number, we have a target, we have a 30 or 50% drawdown by 2030 and 100% by 2039, 2040, 2050, whatever you're working with. Once you do that, you can say to your procurement managers, all right, get after this. And then they can partner with sustainability, and we go into the supply chain and we start working with farms on very specifically the challenges that we face. And I love dairy because I think it is probably one of the most advanced forms of agriculture that we have. Highly skilled farmers that are running cropping systems, animal systems, milking parlors and infrastructure. They have teams and teams of service providers around them, helping them make decisions daily. And whenever there's creatures, whenever there's livestock involved, it's just a different feeling in the space. Sure, we can think about the very, very large farms that might not have that kind of same warm, fuzzy feeling. But at the end of the day, these livestock farms and their demand for carbon neutral grains should catalyze a major growth of regenerative cropping. And when those things start to fit together, I think we're going to see major positive outcomes and co-benefits that we couldn't have even imagined when we launched these things by saying to that farm, I need you to get to net zero. And for those farms that don't have that, they're going to start asking hard questions for their grain supplier. I need that carbon footprint when you sell me that grain. I need to know where it came from. And then once we started asking questions about water and biodiversity, and we have a system and a structure in place that allows us to say, here's our target, this is where I got to go, and this is what I have to measure along the way, I think we're going to see all of us adopt a different mindset and adopt systems and technologies that are going to make it easier.
Well, I love what you're saying, because it talks so much about the kind of taking responsibility of your scope one and even two emissions, and then pushing it upstream scope three, talking about grain suppliers and what are they doing in terms of inputs and sustainability. There's also this kind of methane challenge that seemingly is not yet obvious how we're going to overcome. Talk a little bit about that as a challenge and what solutions you're maybe seeing.
Yeah, I think methane is something we have to live with a little bit. If we want to have animal agriculture, we have to accept that there are manure and cow burps. And those things can be mitigated. I think we're all very excited about the potential for feed additives and rumen modifiers that could significantly reduce the amount of methane that a cow emits. And we also can do a lot of work right now with things that we have at our fingertips, improved forage quality, better feeding regimes, just improved animal welfare overall. And then the manure systems, I think this is both, you know, the opportunity and the challenge that we have to face. And the opportunity side is really for the larger farms, where you can get an anaerobic digester and maybe even additional add-ons to that kind of system and quickly start generating carbon credits through a compliance market that just really makes the whole revenue model work. The smaller farms, this is a much more difficult story, because you need to have a lot of volume in order for these systems to work. And even if you're talking about just like covered lagoons, those don't work when it's really cold to generate enough carbon credits. So I think what we will see is more innovation in the manure space. So right now this is happening naturally, but what else can we do to get some of this organic fertility off that dairy farm and into cropland, where we know putting organic fertility on is probably the number one best thing you can do for soil health, whether that's just improving crop and yield and nutrition, as well as generating a carbon or ecosystem service credit. So I think we're gonna see a massive amount of change in that space. The reason I think dairy catalyzes regenerative is that those dairies, since they're always going to have some emission factor, are probably going to be looking to offset their own emissions in their supply chain. So if we can imagine like a scope four, that is the step at which we could see some major growth in carbon neutral or carbon negative feedstocks.
Has that been frustrating at all to hear this, like, carbon offset ag narrative that's really arisen in the last 18 months of ag can be this place where we help the rest of the economy decarbonize when, I don't know, from where you sit, it's ag still has a lot of work to do itself, but also, yes, it does have this potential. What's your experience been with that kind of ag in the spotlight now as this solution provider? Is that a good thing?
I think overall, it's going to be a good thing for us. I think in reality, it's not the answer. And so on one side, I'm really excited when I'm competing with my supplier for carbon credits because we've all made net zero commitments. Hell yeah. Thank goodness. I would love to have this challenge. Thank you for this challenge. But on the other side of it, if everyone sets their hopes up so high that agriculture is going to support climate change, I want to turn back to you all and say, have you seen what a balance sheet looks like on a farm right now? Like, it is everybody's problem and you're looking for solutions from a group of people that this is not their problem. So I do want us to keep challenging us, and whether that's revenue streams or carbon markets or whatever that looks like we really need to recognize that these are private companies, these are family farms. You're asking them to solve a major, you know, governmental and policy issue. And so unless those solutions are coming side by side, I don't think it's going to be a fair situation. At the end of the day, if we're all thinking about this and we got more people thinking about it and working towards it, the innovation is going to happen. And the farms will not act if it is not market sensibility and there's no business model that can justify a carbon neutral farm. It's not going to happen. So it is on all of us to line up the policy, the financial situation, risk mitigation, and the supply chain opportunities that are going to coalesce in front of that farmer to say, yes, this makes a lot of sense. And if I want to stay in business, if I want to pass my farm down to the next generation, regenerative ag, carbon smart farming is a solution that is right for me. That's the value proposition we have to see in the supply chain.
One of the things you said as well when we were talking about methane was like part of it is accepting it if we want to eat livestock-based products. And obviously there's a group of people that say we shouldn't or that we need more plant-based solutions. Do you see that as a binary answer, or in particular in dairy, one of the things you're excited about is combining those two worlds? Tell me about that.
I'm really excited about the plant-based market. I think it's going to drive more choice for the consumer. It's going to get more people thinking about how they're eating, making different choices. I think that is always a good thing. And the food product innovation space is always really exciting to watch. I do see that many of these food companies are excited also about plant-based products. And so plant-based dairy is, I think, the biggest growing sector of plant-based foods. And the graph that I've tried to think about is you've got that growth trajectory. You've got a good chunk of it will remain in milk from dairy cows. And then that growth is going to be covered by plant-based products. I think that where we could help the dairy farm not feel threatened and really start to embrace and think about the innovation capacity in this space is to look at their own operation if they are growing their own grains. Because I can imagine that we can figure out, and there is a proof of concept with this from a program at Dairy Farmers of America that was run out of Wisconsin, I think a few years ago. So I can imagine a situation where you've got a dairy farmer who has multiple forage crops in rotation, as well as grain crops and corn silage. And can you figure out a rotation that would allow for adding oats or barley or some other product there that I can cut off that grain and send that into the plant-based dairy market and then use the stalks and the stems and feed that to my cows? And then those cows are returning that manure back to that system. And now I'm reducing my synthetic fertilizers to hopefully nothing. And so now I've got a scenario where on that farm, I am providing feedstock into a plant-based dairy system. And I'm providing cow milk into a dairy brand. And I've created a kind of circular economy on my farm and within my co-op, possibly, if we could get some scale around this. And what we end up with are three potential product streams. We have our dairy cow products, we have our plant-based products, and then we can create blended products. So when we find customers that say, hey, I really need to reduce my greenhouse gas factor, but we are a dairy company. We need to put dairy milk on that shelf. Can we look at blending some of these plant-based beverages with dairy milk that gets you almost to a carbon neutral milk product? But it looks, tastes, feels like milk, and it truly is still a dairy product. And that to me is a place where I think we have now shown the innovation potential to dairy farms. We've challenged them with a rotation saying you can actually get a lot more value out of this. And once I start reducing the number of inputs because I'm integrating livestock into those systems and I add the cherry on top of potential ecosystem service market credits, I think we could create a system that at least at pilot scale could be successful. The challenge is how do we scale that in a way that has really great landscape benefits? Because it isn't just about carbon, right? Like we have to work on biodiversity and water especially. And in all of this, we can't forget about our labor force and our workforce development, which is it, obviously we're all feeling it right now.
I love that concept. What do you think the challenges are to scaling it?
Oh man, I would probably be looking at that price of grain and milk every single day, all day long, because as soon as something goes in a different direction, because these are all independent markets and they're disconnected and they're at some point maybe a little distorted by the policy or supports or things that we have in place. I think it would be really hard to keep people in a program or keep them at the scale that we would need. Which contract am I going to break? Is it going to be my oat contract that's bringing me in just a little bit of benefit, or is it going to be the tried and true what my entire system and my insurance is built around, which is my dairy cow? So I think we're going to have to be really strategic in figuring out how do we manage risk and prove out, okay, folks, this is a 3-year timeline. Let's get on board. Don't freak out at year two. We need to get another year through. So I think we have a lot of work ahead of us, but I am super confident that dairy farmers, they pivot fast. I think we have this idea of them that they're slow and they're curmudgeon. No way. These are advanced managers who are paying attention to what the market is doing and they're involved in this space. And these are big systems, so they're not going to disappear overnight.
The R word, the risk word, has come up a few times here. And whether it's embedded insurance or different types of incentives with your downstream partners, what else are you seeing in that space in terms of kind of novel or interesting or even emerging that don't exist yet ways to manage risk that you think have potential?
We can work on risk in a number of ways in our supply chain through contracts, long-term contracts, and some other products like that. I don't see that farmers really like long-term contracts. They'd much rather play the market and have a lot of flexibility and control. I'm sure that you can find an example from every part of the supply chain that would say the opposite, but I do believe that the place that we need to manage risk the most and where I think there's work being done today is around how do we look at climate risk, like extreme weather events. Can we demonstrate that regenerative ag leads to more resilient soils, better water infiltration, so that when those extreme weather events come through, my farm can recover faster? Can we create a kind of climate risk factor on that piece of land that goes into the way that we appraise and value land? So rather than all of us just paying attention to yield and profit, can we also think about our climate risk in that overall valuation of that land and that portfolio of farmland? I think we're going to move towards that space because the operating loan providers, those banks, they're looking at their assets and realizing like yield potential is not going to do it for us for very long. If we really need to grow revenue, we need to make sure we've got resilient farms that will continue to yield under any situation. And how do we make those sure that those farms are whole? And we also need to look at which farms are doing the best work, because those are going to be our lowest risk operators. But we do need some really progressive innovation tools that we can pilot and connect them into what agriculture is really based on in this system of crop insurance and risk management and commodity grain.
How do you see that kind of extension and information diffusion happening? Is it private sector? Is it within specific value chains where like a corporate is rolling out a program for their supply shed? Is it more traditional kind of university or public sector extension? How do you see those information networks evolving as well?
I think these solutions are going to come from new actors in the space that are really trying to work within this system. And that's why I'm really excited to join VEDA. Because we are one of those new companies. We're going to come in and operate farms. We're going to develop that impact agronomy and that regenerative farm cropping system plan. We're going to help sort out all of that ag technology and create like what's that best in class set of sensors and satellite imagery and telemetry that helps that farmer digest all that data so that they can be making good decisions. And all of that starts to get built into a risk profile. And so if we can start to de-risk that transition for every farmer out there, then I think we can say, all right, now we've got a quantity of marketable grain or farm product that has this attribute, and that attribute can be assigned a value. And once we start getting into contract growing situations where you're paying both for that grain and that attribute, how that product was produced, we're starting to value that farmer for their work. And that goes right into that yield and revenue calculation. That farmer gets to go back to their bank with next year and say, I hit my yield goals. My profitability was better. My risk is lower. Help me find more land and help me get a better operating loan and help me invest in XYZ so I can keep doing the system and making it even better.
And what is a chief hub officer? And what will you be doing at VEDA?
I love this title. I think hubs are a word that kind of has come and gone over the last few years. I think that hubs are naturally the way farm systems operate. You could say that every elevator is a potential hub, because from that elevator, that point, I've got a network of farms that I'm originating grain from, for example. And so my role as the chief hub officer at VEDA is to pull together all of the work of my colleagues and put it on the ground and make it happen. So we've got farm operations, we've got an ag tech team, we have an impact agronomy team, and I'm pulling all of that stuff and landing it around our farm in Clarksdale, Mississippi, and establishing a service region. So our farm is a demonstration farm. We're going to do all the testing for you. Come and see how it works for us. And we hope after a few years, we can open our books and show you the financial reality of making this shift. At the same time that we're learning in this space and farming within the community, we're going to develop relationships with partner farmers around us. So how can we bring our technology? How can we bring our consulting services? How can we bring our market access options to the farms and start to generate regenerative products that can hit the supply chain? Because we certainly have seen these farm groups come up on their own. Meadowlark Organics, the Artisan Grain Collaborative. I could provide countless examples of farm groups that are doing this. How do we help those folks scale, accelerate, engage, and tell their story, as well as start to create massive scalable change on the landscape and get those buyers what they need? So what I bring as the hub officer is many relationships with food companies and being able to understand what they're looking for and what the spec is on that grain. So we're a new company. We're only a year old and I've only been there for a few months, but we have potential offtake agreements right now that those buyers are willing to take the risk and work with a new company because we have to. There's not like an existing company out there that's already doing this.
I was going to ask about, do you miss being back at that? We started the conversation around actually farming and like that kind of boots on the ground, but it sounds like you're actually still doing quite a lot of that. So I don't know, maybe that's not a trade-off, but is there a world where you wish you were full-time farming in some sense?
So April 23rd, absolutely not. Every April 23rd, because that was our like cutoff date. If we don't get this ground opened up and our first crops in, our CSA members are not going to be happy. So on April 23rd, I'm always like, so glad I'm not farming anymore. But I miss it like hell. There's just nothing like that lifestyle. So I don't think my love for farming will ever go away. But I know I can be way more successful working with other farmers, and that I can bring my experience, my value, my background, my connections to do a lot more scalable change.
Jessie's journey isn't over yet, but looking back at her career so far, there's a lot to learn. First, for companies that source commodities in their supply chain, improving sustainability metrics is no longer a nice to have or just a marketing play. It's a cost of doing business, driven by both leadership and investors. And the organizations that are finding the most success in this space are those who are able to most closely tie their sustainability teams and goals directly into their procurement work. Second, when it comes to companies supporting regenerative agriculture and net zero, the principles might be paramount, but to execute, people need metrics. Jessie says carbon may be imperfect in terms of quantifying environmental health, but it's the best indicator we have, so it's something companies can and are targeting. Finally, Jessie described a number of ways that the industry, and even individual companies, can do innovative work to get ahead of the curve, from lowering the carbon footprint of milk by blending it with plant-based alternatives, to progressive farmers putting in the work to meet premium supply chains halfway.
and Jesse's own work with Veda, bringing the two ends of the supply chain together by aiming to illustrate the ROI on tech and sustainability. Jesse sees a ton of opportunity to grow financially while minimizing environmental impact. So that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thanks to our guest, Jesse Dilo, Chief Hub Officer at Veda. And of course, thank you for listening. For more information on any of the resources mentioned in this podcast, visit our website at agtechsowhat.com. I'm Sarah Nillette. Catch you next time.